You're listening to another impactful episode of the Combinate Podcast, the show where we drive for quality in everything, because quality is everything. I'm your host, Subi Sade. I've been working on medical devices, pharmaceuticals, and combination products for the last 10 years, and my goal is to understand. Each week, I sit down with leaders to understand and bring together medtech and biotech in order to examine the roadblocks in development and access we face and bring to light concepts and tools from our industry and others to help address those. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade, and I'm excited. I think for me personally, whenever somebody recommends that I talk to someone else, it makes me super excited because Skip came up in a conversation that I was having with Chris Tsai. I think it's a couple of months back at this point. And he was just like, we were talking about design for manufacturability, design for assembly, and that. And Chris was just basically like, you have to talk to Skip. And so we have Skip here today. And so welcome, Skip.
Good to be here.
And so it's funny, I was trying to find your books when I was doing my research. And I just kept looking up Skip Kreveling and some things would come up. But then once I had to look up Clyde Kreveling for the more formal stuff to come out, like books. So FYI, if you're looking up the books, they're by Clyde Kreveling. Could you tell folks a little bit about yourself, Skip? You've had a wide career.
Yeah, everything started back in 82. I had switched my academic pursuits and went into mechanical engineering at Penn State University. Eastman Kodak came along halfway through my educational process and picked me up and said, we want you to come to Rochester. We'll finish paying for your education at Rochester Institute of Technology, which was a good fit. So I joined Eastman Kodak, my Bachelor of Science and Master of Science at RIT. I had a career spanning about 20 years at Eastman Kodak in their office imaging division, doing analog, hybrid, and digital printing systems using electrophotography as the base technology. So my career spanned technology development, product development, and then production support and service support engineering roles. I began to teach adjunct at RIT, and I did that for 7 years in undergraduate and graduate programs there. Then I joined RIT full-time for 4 years. I created a master's program in a blend of product and production systems development, basically for Six Sigma, although you couldn't call it that in those days. Curriculum committees didn't recognize design for Six Sigma, but they certainly recognized the integration of product and production systems engineering. So that's what I did. I left RIT in 2000. And went to work for a Six Sigma consulting firm. They approached me. I had written a couple of books, one on robust design based upon the methods of Junichi Taguchi, who I had met in the early 90s at Kodak, and a book on tolerance development and design. And this Six Sigma group was interested in starting something new. No one had ever heard of a thing called design for Six Sigma. So we created our version of it. And that led to a four-year relationship with them. Then I went on my own and started my own company doing consulting and training. And that company is called Product Development Systems and Solutions Incorporated. So I've done that for 20 years now, and I'm in the final days of that career. I still do some training and consulting, but the end is near, but not quite here yet. So like Phil Collins says, I'm not dead yet. So
that's funny.
That's a thumbnail of my background.
Yeah, that's when we were talking last week in prep for the interview, you said you basically consult for your friends now.
Yeah. People that I've trained who come back, they've risen in their career path. They're typically come to me now as a vice president of research and development, product development. And they asked, can you please come train my people like you trained me? And it's hard to say no. So
yeah, I do it. So you talked about robust design, and that's what Chris started talking about. And he said, you know, essentially my road to robust design stops here. You got to talk to Skip. Can you elaborate on robust design?
Yeah, in the early 90s at Eastman Kodak, we were working on a brand new pure digital printing system. And our track record with developing reliable systems was not good. We were pretty good at subsystem development, but our ability to integrate a group of robust and tunable subsystems into a reliable, durable, robust system were poor. And so we asked our senior leadership at Kodak, can we bring in these consultants that we've been reading, Don Clausing from MIT, Junichi Taguchi, father of robust design, and then Stuart Pugh, who was very well known in the world of concept development, evaluation, and selection from the University of Strathclyde in Scotland.
Is that like Pugh Matrix?
Yeah, it's him. Wow. Stuart Pugh created the Pugh Matrix. So those are the three guys that trained me at Kodak. And I spent about 2 years with those guys. Well, Stuart didn't come very much. He contracted, unfortunately, a pretty severe brain malady, and it ultimately took his life. So my time with Stuart was much shorter, but I spent a ton of time with Taguchi. And he kind of took me under his wing and mentored me. I studied under him, his son, and a guy named Dr. Madhav Fodke. And those guys really trained me in the methods of robust design. And I took it from there along with colleagues at Kodak. And that led to us developing an internal training program and consulting program across Eastman Kodak. And ultimately, we wrote a book. Addison Wesley approached us to write a book with rich in case studies and practical guidance around the methods of robust design. Mm.
What was it like to meet somebody like Taguchi or Pugh at the time? I mean, were they known in that way at that time, or did that happen later?
Taguchi was very well known in the United States, particularly at Xerox and Ford Motor Company, AT&T Bell Labs. He'd been around a fair amount, and he was kind of like the opposite of Deming, where Deming went to Japan and became very highly respected and famous, and the Japanese loved him. Mm. And Taguchi came here and started to teach and promote the methods of robust design, and people in this country found his approach very unique and welcomed him with open arms, because he was an engineer's engineer. He loved talking about the laws of conservation of energy and mass and how they really ruled everything, and that quality only came after you obeyed the law. And so I always tell people, when I train you, I'm going to teach you a course in obeying the law. And it breaks down into following the mass and energy of a system or a subsystem, what have you, measuring continuous variables that are either scalar or vector in nature, because they tell us the truth, the foundational root cause of why something functions. And then quality can be developed to whatever level you're willing to invest in it. But you have to start with fundamentals at the physics and chemistry level of how things function.
Can you walk through an example of that?
Sure. We were trying to improve paper feeding in our printers. Mm. And we were counting the number of jams per unit time. That is an attribute measure of failure. A jam is not a function, it's a failure, it's an after effect of a functional anomaly. And so Taguchi worked with us, as well as Don Clausing, because Clausing had worked at Xerox in paper handling prior to going to MIT. And basically they said, you're gonna have to change what you measure. So we switched from counting jams to measuring the position of paper in time and space in linear and angular coordinates. And as we saw paper arriving early or late, or in some manner skewed, in its orientation to lasers. We were using Kant's measurement systems at the time. And so we had a really good handle on positional accuracy and precision, accuracy being the average of a thing and precision being the standard deviation of a thing, a function, a position in this case. And so we could measure over time the statistics, the sample statistics of variation of paper position in time, and we could predict when the position of the paper would ultimately lead to a jam. And so we shifted from after the fact failure to an ability to measure the onset of variation that would ultimately lead to a jam. And then we could do something about it in the area of the printer where the parts, the materials, the subassemblies, the subsystems were in some way, shape or form changing either internally with their own material properties and functions, or due to some unwanted source of variation outside of the internal mechanisms and materials of the subsystem. And that phenomenon that attacks functions from outside of the system or subsystem is called noise, which is simply any form of unwanted source of variation that can disrupt your function and cause ultimately a failure in performance, which of course, then the metrics of reliability are used, mean time to failure and things like that. In our case, mean images between service calls to correct jamming in this paper handling case.
Okay.
So that's a pretty good example of what we mean by working to attain robustness based upon measuring physics and in this case, positional dynamics.
Understood. So, okay. So, you know, essentially you moved from the failures per time to yep. something that was more representative of the intended function. And so this wasn't in relation to, because you mentioned accuracy and precision, right? And I've seen yeah. that obviously used in test method validation in regulated industries, but that's yep. generally after the fact. It's not used to validate methods that are used to influence design changes.
Well, we use accuracy or the mean and precision, the standard deviation, in any form of sampling statistics during technology and product development. So as I mentioned to you when we first met, there are seven things, I call them the big seven, that we focus on when we're developing any form of new technology or improving an existing design. And the first three of those are, can I measure a function? Is the function stable? And thirdly, can I adjust the function over a desirable range of performance to hit a target based upon the customer satisfaction indicators? And so those three things form the foundation of an ability to identify performance. And if there's a problem in any of those three, we would say that there's a critical parametric situation that thus was born the body of knowledge known as critical parameter identification, development, and management. We call it critical parameter management for short, but inside that those metrics, you have to be able to measure continuous variables and be able to calculate on a sampling basis the mean and the standard deviation. And from there, we can really do something to develop insight to optimize the function.
Mm. So those were the first three. What are the rest?
Yeah, the other four, the fourth one is all about input or controllable variables we call X's, and the output variables we call Y's. So everything we do in robust design or critical parameter development is all about Y as a function of X. And of course, this is the foundation of all the mathematics we've all learned over the years, whether it be basic mathematics or algebra, trigonometry, calculus, and beyond. Y as a function of X is called the transfer function. And the X is, we have to know, and this is the fourth metric, is which X's are statistically significant in controlling our Y's, which X's are independent of one another versus dependent or interactive with one another. This is particularly of interest in chemistry and biology. And that gives us a sense of which X's are the most important to least important in controlling our functional Y's. The fifth is called hypersensitivity. Designs can go to war with themselves by poor design or poor execution of design integration. And so when you have design that is causing unwanted variation simply because of crosstalk, or you might call it entanglement with itself. Think of your heart. If your heart has a genetic anomaly in it, it's inbred to your DNA, and you may have heart troubles, not because of anything external to your body, but because the heart has somehow developed a problem within your own body. We see in medical examples, our bodies become intolerant of other chemical reactions or electrochemical phenomenon. And we would call that hypersensitivity. And that maybe type 1 diabetes, you might call that in glucose terms, a hypersensitivity. Through no fault of your own, your body is at war with itself. The next one is called robustness. That's number six. That's a different form of sensitivity. That's where a design's function has sensitivities to three different sources of noise, unit to unit or part to part or material to material, batch to batch variational sensitivity. The second is external sensitivity or environmental sensitivity to some form of mass, energy, or information that's getting inside the design's function from outside of the system itself that causes seeing precision problems. The mean and the standard deviation do things that you don't want them to do. And now we have to figure out, how do we design parametrically with our X's and Y's to become minimally sensitive to those sources of unwanted variation? So that's the purpose of robust design, number six. And number seven, of course, is the classic capability index, CP, CPK, or PP and PPK, if you're used to working modern statistical software like Minitab or Jump. They'll report out capability indices, which is simply the ratio of what is required in relationship to what is actually measured. And so CP and CPK is the seventh of our big seven metrics. Those seven things are used during technology and product and process development to tell us how healthy are our functions. And if there's a problem with any one or more of the big seven, then we have isolated a critical parameter environment for us to focus our work on to improve the design before we launch it into production and lifecycle management. Mm. Of course, if a design is hopelessly flawed conceptually, the big seven are going to tell us about it. And then we may have to abandon the design architecture and go back to the Pew matrix and come up with a new design architecture that does enable us to attain fulfillment of the big seven. Even if some of the big seven are still problematic, we may find out that we can control them through some form of improvement, that we can live with it even though it's still flawed. We still can survive it and put it into the commercial market.
When you were first talking, I thought that these were sort of done in sequence, but it sounded towards the end like these are done in parallel.
They are done in staggered parallel. So one begets the next, and staggered parallel means there's overlaps. Yeah. You know, where you may be working on robustness and capability simultaneously. Measurability is not. You have to do that first. If you can't measure a function, you're done.
So capabilities first?
No, first is measurability.
Measurability. And that's the first three, right?
Yeah. You can measure a function, good. Then you can tell if it's stable, better. And then you can tell if you can adjust the function, much like your steering wheel on your car or your brakes on your car. They attenuate your performance to some desired target.
And then the input output, is that just like voice of customer or?
Well, the voice of the customer begins our understanding of tolerance. What is tolerable to a customer in some range of tunability. Rarely will a customer say it has to be perfectly this point. They'll say, I would like this to be somewhere in this range of functional performance that will meet my needs. And so inputs and outputs are really our X's and our Y's in the design's functional architecture.
Oh, so it's like
limits, the upper and lower spec limits and target are based upon and derivative of the voice of the customer.
Understood. So the number four input output is more akin to some sort of regression?
Yes.
Okay. So
regression analysis is the study of Y as a function of X.
Okay. So that makes sense. I think obviously you've done some work in the medical device and pharma space. And so I'm coming into this discussion with my own baggage. And so I'm thinking the design input, the design output. And while that may be linked in some way, that it's not exactly that, because especially design input is measurability of, you know, essentially voice of customer.
Sure.
Okay. And so I'm interested in six and seven, to be honest, because robust, did you say there were three sources of variation? Because I got unit to unit / batch to batch. I got external environmental, but I didn't get the third one.
The third, I forgot that. Thank you for reminding me, is deterioration.
Deterioration.
So think of wear out phenomenon in terms of engineering science. It's called entropy. Things tend to wear down into disorder from a higher state of order. So we think of the brakes on your car, they wear out. That's deterioration noise.
Yeah.
Because of the frictional wear on the pad material.
So in my industry, it would be akin to stability, or if there's, I mean, multi-use is more hardware generally speaking, but if there's a multi-use element, anything like that. I mean, I remember when I worked in infusion pumps, we would always do like a burn-in test, and then we would test thereafter, right, as part of verification. So it makes sense. And then how is the capability index? I've typically seen that used in process validation for sure, right? But because I've heard of this concept of design capability, but I haven't really seen, you know, much related to it, because when from a stats point of view, they typically use confidence and reliability, and they don't get to using CPK, PPK and that.
Yeah, in my body of knowledge that I've written about over the last 20 years, CP and CPK is used in technology development and in product and process development. Anytime you have a function, Y is a function of X, where Y is a continuous variable that you can measure, and you can then do sample statistics, basically using the T distribution, if your samples are fewer than 30, then you can define normality or the lack thereof of the distribution of the sample data. And from there, once you have that ability, you can affix the distribution with upper and lower spec limits and a target, and you're off to the races, because you have everything you need to do a capability study. And I don't care if it's a product function or a process function, any continuous variable Y, scalar or vector in its measurement will allow you to develop a capability index. And when we do that early on in development, we have a metric called the capability growth index. The capability growth index. And we watch how capability grows and improves over time through design iteration and maturation.
So if I understood that correctly, while, you know, in my experience, like I said, CPK, PPK, they're used in process validation for sure. But what you're saying is, if you do your product development in a way where you account for the number four input output controllable variable, creating an output that is measurable, then you can do CPK, PPK. But if you're not following that, then it's not possible to do it that way.
Well, back in the early days of Kodak, we were just counting failures in our subsystems when we were developing them. There was some continuous variable measurement. You know, we did do what you'd call good physics-based measurement of functional behavior, but some things were hard to measure in terms of scalars and vectors. And when I say a scalar, I mean something that just has magnitude. And when I say a vector, I mean something that has directionality and magnitude of its performance. And so temperature is a scalar, right? So if you're measuring the temperature of something, it's just how high or low is it? If you're measuring acceleration or velocity, those are scalars, right? Those have both magnitude and direction of effect. So anytime you can develop something and mature it, improve it, optimize it as a functional relationship of X's and Y's, you can do capability studies on it. And you can, in fact, report back to upper management, how well are we improving CP and CPK as we develop our sub-assemblies, subsystems, and the system integration. So you have a whole flow down from system CP and CPK down to sub-level design performance, right down to part dimensions, material characteristics, and even into the production processes that make those dimensional parts or some form of material characteristic that you care about. So we can go right down the hierarchy of a system, right into its manufacturing processes, and have this linked set of CPs and CPKs. And we can watch them get better and better and better as we develop the product, develop the process.
How, you know, when you were, because you talked about teaching and you sort of, I think, took a transition, excuse me, after Eastman Kodak, where you spent a good chunk of time teaching at RIT. I'm wondering, how simple is it to teach folks this kind of methodology? And how long does it take to really see a shift in, because it seems relatively simple. It doesn't seem like, at least as far as I can tell, right? And I looked at the DFSS book kind of table of contents that right. You have. It seems like simple, not easy kind of thing.
Yeah, I would not call the body of knowledge known as Design for Six Sigma and the subset of it, critical parameter development and management, hard. And the mathematics is pretty straightforward. I mean, any sufficiently trained person with an undergraduate or a graduate education in engineering or chemistry or what have you is not going to find this stuff hard. My view of Design for Six Sigma is it's just about everything that we didn't have time to put into our curriculum because I taught mechanical engineering. And so that curriculum is fixed. There's not we have opportunity to take electives. And some of my courses like tolerance design and robust design were senior electives to a person getting a BS in engineering. But I also made them so they could be part of a graduate program for master's students. And so there was a crossover point where some of the tools and methods of Design for Six Sigma became rigorous courses. I had to develop them and take them through curriculum committee and get, you know, the curriculum committee to buy off on them. And that I accomplished that. So, but they were electives. They were never formally adapted to be sort of the core of mechanical engineering education.
Well, I think it's hard too, because I mean, even through my own education, right, we had some regulatory related industry courses that were taught by people with say PhDs from industry. And those were all electives, even though they were some of the most helpful courses that we took. So I hear you there. As far as, you know, you talked about CPM, you talked about tolerancing. I think a pattern that I saw is you were looking at the defining of that which is critical versus that which is, you know, only important,
nearly important.
And so can you just talk about that? I mean, do you find that people sort of get lost in the weeds calling everything important?
Yes.
And what is the CPM methodology? I mean, you mentioned that it was the first three of the seven, but can you elaborate on it?
Sure. Back when Design for Six Sigma was coming into being, there were various consultants who were trying to figure out how to focus people. And there was a particular consultant who said, thing that the customer says is important to them, we're going to call that TQ, You may have heard of a CTQ, critical to quality. Well, that's all well and good, except the sheer volume of CTQs was massive. So we tried a CTQ at Kodak way back when Six Sigma was, you know, what you would have found at Motorola. Motorola came and trained us in classic DMAIC Six Sigma for problem solving and production processes. So we looked at this notion of CTQs and we very quickly found that it was overwhelming. You can't call everything that is important to a customer critical to quality and then put it under rigorous statistical process control and capability measurement with your supply chain. That makes parts and materials inspection and qualification extraordinarily costly. And so we started to search for a better, more precise definition of criticality. And it didn't take me long after hanging out with Dr. Taguchi to say, it's the function, right? It's like James Carville says, it's the economy, stupid, right? Well, to us, it was, of course, it's the function. And if our functions are sensitive to noise and are not on target with low variation, that's what's critical. And so we changed the word quality to function. And that took us away from attribute statistics to continuous variable statistics. That was the aha moment to us and our search for focusing ourselves on everything's important in the design. Absolutely, you got to have it. If it's not important, design it out of the machine, right? Get rid of it. But then we discovered that there were certain areas within our functional architecture that were new, unique, or difficult. And you'll hear anyone that you talk to that's been trained by me, you'll hear them talk about NUDs and ECOs.
NUDs?
NUDs, N-U-D, new. It's a new function, or it's a unique function to your company that someone else has mastered, but you have not, and therefore you have problems with it. Or it's difficult, new, unique, and or difficult. Some functions are difficult to optimize, right? To design and optimize. That's the area of embryonic or candidate critical parameters. The opposite of NUD is easy, common, and old, ECO. If a function is easy to control and develop, great. If it's common, that means it's common across industry and there are standards around it. Everybody knows about it. And then old, it's been around for years and years. Everybody knows how to handle these parameters. And so they're low risk and are quickly resolved when you're doing leverage design. ECOs are typically things we can develop quickly and easily, as the name implies. And they're important, but they're not challenging to us. Whereas the NUDs will buckle your knees. They're hard.
Okay, so is it a situation where you avoid the NUDs or?
Sometimes you have no choice. Anytime you innovate, you create NUDs.
Okay.
Purely by the newness of an innovation or an invention or its follow-on activity, innovation, those by definition will produce NUD functions, new, unique, or difficult functions. And that's why we have technology development and product and process development processes is to tame and control the NUDs and the ECOs. And harmonize them together.
And then, so that was CPM. What about tolerancing?
Tolerancing is how you deal typically with NUDs. Oh. So if you have a difficult function and the only way to tame it and to get it to do what you want is to really have tight tolerances or ultra expensive material, you know, characteristics, then unfortunately, we have an expensive design, a costly design to manufacture and to integrate. But if we do have a controllable system of NUDs, we still have a product. We still have a process, albeit it might be expensive.
Is there any major distinctions between kind of your tolerancing methodology, you know, based on you and Taguchi's work versus standard GD&T?
GD&T is the ability to communicate a tolerance. GD&T does little to develop one based upon the known laws of physics and critical parametrics. So when I wrote my book on tolerance design, I got a hold of Lowell Foster, the father of modern geometric dimensioning and tolerancing.
What was the name?
What
was the name?
Lowell Foster. If you buy any of the books on geometric dimensioning and tolerancing, he probably wrote them. I don't know if Lowell is still alive or not, but he wrote some material that was featured on the back of my tolerancing book, explaining his view of what I had done.
Was it favorable?
Oh, very. We're like symbiotic, you know. If you do critical parametric work and do analytical and statistical tolerancing, which I wrote about, either using a computer or doing designed experiments to empirically derive tolerance limit. Monte Carlo simulation is computer-aided tolerancing, and design of experiments is empirical-based tolerance analysis, where you test high and low limits to find out the functional performance range of a design, and then you can derive your final upper and lower spec limits from that empirical data.
Understood. I wanted to switch gears just a little bit and talk about Six Sigma for marketing, because that was one of your books. And I've seen Six Sigma for dummies, Six Sigma for everything, right? Never for marketing. What was that about? What made you come up with that idea?
It came from my relationship with M Corporation. It sort of forced the issue. We were writing about design for Six Sigma for technology and product development. And our approach to it basically came from starting with the voice of the customer and the voice of technology. So voice of technology is all physics and chemistry and life sciences, physical knowledge of how things work. Voice of the customer comes from end users and people in the chain of specification development, requirements development from the user side. And so we were at 3M, and Jim McNerney was the CEO at the time. You would remember him also as the CEO of Boeing until a few years ago, but he was an acolyte of Jack Welch in the 3M or in the GE days of Six Sigma. And so when Jim came to 3M, he said, I want to do design for Six Sigma, but it has to be in two flavors that are integrated across marketing functions and engineering and technology functions. So we developed a body of knowledge that was harmonious between developing what I call inbound marketing data and inbound technology development. So the technology side of 3M was inventing and innovating all kinds of clever new technologies. And McNerney was frustrated because he had a very anemic inbound marketing organization that didn't know what to do with this stuff. And in fact, nobody was pushing the technologists to look into market research before they went off and invented something. So McNerney said, I want to change 3M to a hybrid front-end innovation company where there was a partnership between inbound marketing and technology development. And so we developed a whole bunch of courses and training materials to train marketers to get the voice of the customer right, and to also, well, there was an old saying at 3M was, do the right products, the right mix of products, which is portfolio development, the right way, which is product development. And so portfolio renewal and development was improved and optimized with this marketing for Six Sigma push. And that's what the impetus was.
Was there an introduction of new tools, or was it reframing sort of the define? Because I guess what I'm hearing is that maybe it was, you know, instead of defining an engineering problem, it's defining you know, a market need. And instead of measuring empirical data for an engineering problem, it's defining what characteristics you're going to look at from an inbound marketing point of view and so on.
Exactly.
Oh.
Voice of the customer, identification, acquisition, processing, and translation into the classic Design for Six Sigma tool, the House of Quality, which is the handshake between inbound marketing and product development, when you basically say, what is the marketing requirements? And now how do I translate them into technical requirements? And that happened to be the expertise area of Dr. Don Clausing, one of the great three men that trained me.
Wow, that's awesome. I guess as we close, what is a book that changed your life? Maybe not an engineering book.
Well, I would say reading Clausing's book, Total Quality Development, was pretty important from a technical perspective, but I would say that the whole body of knowledge around, well, there was no book on tolerancing, but I found a stack of articles and papers about 3 feet thick that I read them all and integrated them into my book on tolerancing design. So reading other people's developmental suggestions and guidance. And then if you were to ask, what's my hallmark skill? It's integration. So I went around and gathered up everything I could find around technology and product development and read that stuff and then integrated it. And that became my flavor of Design for Six Sigma.
Have you read a book called How to Read a Book by Mortimer J. Adler?
No.
It was written by one of the professors at University of Chicago, Adler, who's a very famous person. And he says the highest level of reading, I think it's called sequential reading. I'll have to go back and just enjoy, sequential or symbiotic or something like that. But it is where you take a stack of books and read them in a way that's cohesive. And you're trying to understand, well, based on this body, what is my opinion? What are my thoughts on this overall topic? And so you're looking at different sides of the coin. And so that's super cool that essentially you can find a book that, you know, gave you all the different angles and you just read, you know, a big stack of papers and then came up with your own. What is
I had to say one book just out of all books that really affected me was Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Oh, really?
I can't tell you how many people I've come across who think that Atlas Shrugged is probably the greatest book they've ever read.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
But it's all about objectivism.
Yeah. Okay. And then what is something you're excited about?
I'm excited about what the former CEO of Illumina, Jay Flatley, talked to me about 6 or 7 years ago when I met him. Illumina is the world's foremost gene sequencing company. And Jay told me what was coming in the next 7 to 10 years in terms of the ability to sequence the genome and then do derivative work in cancer treatment, Alzheimer's treatment, prevention, heart disease, diabetes. So I am extremely excited about anybody and everybody in the gene sequencing community and the people who use gene sequencers to develop the therapies and either proactively or reactive therapies to help us live healthier lives.
Yeah,
I'm pretty excited about that.
Gene therapy is one of the, what's the word? Most sought after, say, modalities in pharma. I think most companies have some permutation, and the CRISPR work is unbelievable.
Yes, CRISPR is amazing. And yeah, if you want to read something exciting about the future, look at CRISPR.
Yeah. Well, very good. I think we need to do a separate episode on your experience in pharma and medical device because we didn't touch on that. And that's mostly my audience, right? But I really appreciate you walking through, it was a lot. I certainly learned a ton. I think I called them the seven technology and process development.
Think of them as a filter.
Filter. Okay. A funnel.
A funnel.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. I call them the big seven.
The big seven. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Skip, for coming on. I appreciate the time, sir.
Okay.
Peace.